Hello and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. This is Wade here in the podcast studio, still spring break edition, as we are being ambitious and getting a few episodes done. Joined by my spring breaking colleagues, my dear friends, the Reverend Dr. Michael Berg and the Reverend Professor Jason Oakland. And we are going to be discussing today the episode title I had in mind is Getting Virtued. The Lord taketh away and the Lord giveth. And the idea being there, when we talk about virtue, and in Christianity, when we talk about virtue, we're often talking about things that people relate to sanctification, right? How does one become virtuous? How does that take place? What's the place of virtue in the Christian church? How does that fit with what we call justification and sanctification? What's God's role in that? What's neighbor's role in that? What's my role in that? That's what I have in mind. And the idea of getting virtued, we're going to get a little bit at. Yes, there's a place. I do things to become virtuous to a degree, but also especially that my virtue as a Christian comes from God going to work on me. We're going to have a discipline. This is the new Let the Bird Fly. And we've stayed 35 to 40 minutes so far, and we're going to do that again as the most disciplined member of the cast. Would we say we're a cast of the cohort?
Yeah.
I am going to keep us in line.
Would you consider discipline a virtue?
I would.
Oh,
and I have been disciplined.
Yes.
By the Lord and Michael.
Yes.
Okay.
To keep this to the time range.
In that, in that spirit, the given name Wade.
Okay, right. This is a callback to a previous episode. So if you didn't hear the previous episode, this is why Michael's doing this.
We went through famous Jasons, now we're going to do famous Wades.
Yes.
It's slim picking, buddy.
I know.
But there is
something Norwegian. There was like a Norwegian god or something.
So there is, you know, it's Anglo-Saxon, English origin, means probably from the verb to go, but it also came like a ford, you know?
It's funny because you're always telling me to leave.
Yeah. The given name Wade was first recorded in the Little Doomsday Book of Norfolk, Suffolk, and Essex in 1086. Owing its popularity to the legend of Wade, a sea giant, who was dreaded and honored by the coastal tribes of the North Sea and the Baltic Sea. So that's maybe where you get that from. So
Vada, I bet it was Vada.
Vada, yeah. So you're Wade Box.
Mm-hmm. Famous
Wade Miley,
beer drinker on an airplane, if I recall.
Yeah. Wade Miley, current Brewers pitcher, right?
Oh.
Wade...
is there a Wade Phillips? Mussolini?
Nope, Wade Phillips, right?
Oh, football
awesome.
Coach.
Head
yeah.
coach, yeah. Other than that, oh boy, I haven't heard of any of them. And there's Wade Ward, an American old-timey music banjo player.
You've never heard of Wade Ward?
Yeah, no.
No, neither have I. I was just trying to
play
it up.
there was another one that I thought was, Wade McNeil, Canadian singer and guitarist of the post-hardcore band Alexis on Fire.
Ooh.
No statesman either, huh?
No
Jason or Wade statesman.
There was a Wade Allison, who's a British physicist and Oxford professor. Other than that, I mean, which to your advantage is if you get yourself a Wikipedia page.
I just
page,
searched famous Wades, and there's a Wade Hampton III, but it looks like he's wearing a possibly Confederate uniform.
Oh.
So,
yeah.
Yes, there's a bunch of Wade Hampton.
I might want to look a little bit into that
from
one.
From the South.
Scandalous.
Wade Redden, hockey player.
American soldier in the Revolutionary War. American plantation owner. American Civil War soldier. Florida lawyer.
All I want to say is that
those are all
states'
Wade
rights
Hamptons.
Do matter.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
All right. This show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We'll be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism.
Yes.
Because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Can you imagine my childhood if it had been Mario? Once Nintendo became big?
You'd been worldwide, man.
It would have been... Yeah. Oh, I would have got grief like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
They probably would have called me Not So Super Mario.
Possibly.
That's what I would have called me if I were. Yeah. I was a mean kid.
Yeah. Did your brother have an alternate name? It wasn't Luigi,
no,
was it?
He has the first name. Uh-huh. Like, they went super traditional. Him, like, the first name a human being ever had.
Huh? Yeah.
They got all the special out with Wade. All right, that brings us to our main topic, getting virtued. And I think there's two ditches Lutherans can fall into when they talk about virtue. One, I'm going to call this maybe the early impulse, as you have Luther reacting against Aristotle, the Reformation kicking off, really a felt need, but a real need to react against the intrusion of Greek philosophy into theology in some very unhelpful ways. That camp, that ditch would be to kind of just toss out virtue as a thing, at least to toss out virtue in the church, speaking of it in a way that would sound too Greek.
The broad picture is, how much do you throw out Aristotle?
Yeah. Right. The other ditch would be to try to bring Aristotle in too much, and maybe... And this doesn't mean someone studied Aristotle or philosophy, but it's to conflate sanctification and something like a virtue ethic, where when we talk about sanctification and we make the narrow definition the guiding one. So broad definition of sanctification biblically is everything God does to save us, to make us a saint. The narrow definition, which is probably the one that comes to mind when modern Lutherans hear the word, and that is reflected most often in preaching, is growth in the Christian life. And I wouldn't argue, I don't know that the proper narrow definition is growth in Christian life, but the idea of growth becomes central to it. And then the temptation, if it's growth, it should be measurable, right? And this becomes kind of like almost worse than Aristotle, because it puts an immense pressure on you. You're not just building character, which would have been very important for Aristotle to reach eudaimonia, happiness, right, to flourish. But it kind of makes its way into your relationship with God. And so this becomes where you get like principle heaven Christianity, principle heavy Christianity, or you get kind of the Jesus as a better way. And, you know, the Ten Commandments are really for your own good, which is not false. God does give us the Ten. They're good for us. My marriage is better if I don't commit adultery, right? My family life is better if my kids honor and respect me and I don't exasperate them. I do better in the workplace if I don't steal. I mean, I do steal. You guys don't know about it because I do it on the down low. But if
I was a little short on that chocolate money, I was saying.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
I don't know.
To keep our eyes open.
I don't know where the caramels went. What do you guys say, by the way? Caramel, caramel?
Caramel.
Caramel.
But this kind of, it becomes a pull yourself up by the bootstrap sanctification, maybe. And for that reason, becomes more about growing up than growing down, becoming rooted. And so what is the place of virtue? The church has, from its beginning, talked about Christian virtue. Paul, almost in every letter at some point, gives a list that describes what the Christian life looks like. And I would note that he doesn't usually describe, for sin he often describes specific works, but for virtue, He describes dispositions.
And relationships.
And relationships more often. Not just like checklist works. So what is the place of that? What is the role of that? I would say, at least if I can speak for Michael, and I won't say as much for Jason, because you don't have as much of an edge. And that's it's one of the endearing things about you. We probably spent, I would say, an early part of our ministry reacting, probably, is it fair to say, Michael, pretty sharply to the overemphasis on this narrow kind of American evangelical sanctification. I think we've both come around to where Let the Bird Fly isn't just like, oh, you know, we're weak on sanctification, but that what does it mean to live the Christian life? And you've written on the baptismal life and on vocation. I've picked up similar themes, and I'm teaching of all things ethics. So what is the place for this then? And maybe if I just hit on what Aristotle's getting at, and then I'll throw it to you guys. So for Aristotle, when we're talking virtue ethics, we're talking about the notion of Aristotle saying, what's the goal of human life? What's the telos? So if you're teleological, that means life is goal-driven. And he says, well, what I'm going to look at the human experience. What is the goal? What is good? And he says it's happiness. But he doesn't mean happiness like we often mean it. It's not just pleasure in avoiding suffering.
Or feeling.
Right, especially not primarily feeling. For him, happiness is, we would probably call it character, good character. It's being virtuous. And it's habituating yourself to virtue in a way that it becomes second nature. Aristotle would not be able to wrap his head around sayings like we have in our own day where we say, yeah, he did that, but he's a good person. Aristotle said, well, your actions reflect who you are. Jesus says that to a degree, right?
Stupid is as stupid does.
Yeah. And, my favorite meme back from, like, peak meme days, which, you know, like, Harambe memes, Bush did 9/11, like, that was really the heyday. And there was one, and it's a person, and we don't even have to say what gender they were, but they're getting ready to, like, go out to the club, and you can just tell, okay, it's kind of, they're being a little edgy and scandalous, and then it says, only God can judge me. And then it has God in heaven, and he says, you're a whore, right? But, like, Aristotle, like, only God can, like, we dismiss that as, like, well, I'm a good person, you know, only God can judge me. A, that should be the most terrifying person to judge you. He's got no sin. He's the holiest being in existence. For Aristotle, virtue, happiness then, good spirits, human flourishing, is making virtue second nature. And for him, how that happens is you get habituated to it. Once again, you just keep doing it till it becomes second nature. Think left-handed layups in grade school basketball. I don't know if either of you ever coached grade school basketball, but I didn't. Why do we have to do left-hand layup drills? Because you can't make them. Well, that's why we don't want to do them. We can't make them. Right. So we're going to get you so you can make them, and you do them again and again. And then you get the one kid in a game, makes it like it's set, you know, like it's just a habit, and you go, yes. And then another kid on your team scores on the wrong hoop, and you remember that we live in a fallen world. But the idea simply of, I'm going to work at it, and Michael hit in a previous episode, hit on the fact that for the Greeks then, the big problem is ignorance. If I just teach you the right things, then you won't sin because you'll know better, and you can habituate yourself to it. So when we say Aristotle, that's at least what I have in mind. I'll toss it to either of you now to react to this notion of the two ditches. What is virtue? Is there a place for Christian virtue? How should we think of it? Any of that?
Yeah, so more I'm engaged with younger generation, you know, and they keep getting younger, and I keep staying the same age. Yeah.
Although you mean that in a less creepy way than the reference. Yes.
So it's not so much, my concern is not so much that we try to make them virtuous. Like, the threat is not like, oh my goodness, they're, if we talk about virtue, they're going to become, they're going to become law-oriented, you know, semi-Pelagians. There's plenty other ways that we do that in the church. But the fact that they don't even know what they are, right? It's not like they're tempted to become virtuous for the sake of their own sanctification and mixing that with justification. They don't even know what they are. there's only one virtue, and that is be yourself, right? And that's troubling, right? And so a part of me wants to, man, we should, like, all of our, like, from very little on, they should be able to memorize the list of the virtues and
right.
all this. And, but the danger, I think, really is, as you said before, an Aristotelian or a Christian way of looking at it. What are those two different ways? And this is oversimplification, but Aristotle is going to be becoming before being, where Christ is going to be being before becoming. And so in both cases, habits are important, character is important, formation is important. For Aristotle, you do the becoming, and then you are going to be the thing, right? You're not born a piano player, you practice being a piano player, then you're going to be a piano player. Which is, and we distinguish between, you know, things that are, you know, things above, things below. This is really good advice for being a piano player.
Yep. For things below, this works great.
This is, in fact, we probably need to tell those kids more and more, right? So with things below, this generation has the being before the becoming. Well, I'm an awesome basketball player because I was told to believe in myself, and in my driveway, I'm like Michael mm-hmm. Jordan, right? And they don't think they have to work at it in a lot of ways. But when things above, which has to do with things below too, right? This is not a clear line when it comes to the actual getting played out in day-to-day life. Christ would say, you're a dead tree. Dead tree can't do anything. I need to make you a good tree. When I make you a good tree, then you will produce good fruit. So this is sinner-saint thing, right? Where the sinner is always going to sin and the saint's always going to saint. So for then...
Yeah, you know what a dead body can do? It can float, but it can't swim.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how does it swim?
Yeah.
So we have to realize that we are made something different, and that something different is going to play itself out. And this is Christ working through me. I'm still a sinner, and so I mess up. So then that changes a little bit in two ways how you look at virtue. For Aristotle, the telos is the virtuous life or the virtue itself, virtue for the sake of virtue, or if you want theologically, sanctification for the sake of sanctification, which I think is a lot of the evangelical and American sanctification. I'm trying to be a good person for myself. You just have sprinkled a little holiness on there.
Mm-hmm.
So the first problem would be the telos in the Christian ethic is neighbor. And if the concentration is on neighbor, you don't really care so much if you're being patient or not. You're actually caring about patience for that person, right? The second thing that I would say different between Aristotelian ethics and Christian ethics, not doing justice to either one, so with a caveat there. So the golden mean in Aristotle is brilliant and beautiful, and I think we should work through that more, right? So you have this, you have these two impulses. One is, to run into the fire and not think of your own safety. The other one is to run away from the fire and not think about anything else but your safety. And the golden mean would be courage, right? So you're not haphazard. You're not.
Right. You can't be courageous if you're not afraid.
And then one that would be driven by fear and self-preservation. I think that's good. But a Christian way of thinking about it is more to say, instead of me trying to find this golden mean, this plays out naturally in my vocation. I'm called to do this at this particular time for the sake of neighbor. And then I look through it, not so much through the golden mean, although that's helpful, not totally dismissing it. But you ask yourself the question, who's doing it? So we've taught this before, but I think it's really, really important. And there's a book out here entitled that hasn't yet to be written, and that is Virtue for the Sinner Saint. And that is, you, instead of saying, okay, here are the two extremes, what's the golden mean, you ask yourself, who's doing it? So what's contentment? Contentment would be a good thing. We would call it virtuous, I suppose. Maybe it's not directly a virtue, but you know what I mean. The sinner is discontent for selfish reasons, or content for selfish reasons. I'm discontent because this world owes me something, or I'm content with the frivolous things of this world. The saint is content and discontent for the right reasons, right? So it's not so much about, I found the golden mean of contentment. It is in what situation, who's the neighbor, and who's doing the contenting, to make up a word, right? Hmm. The saint is going to be discontent in this world, how could you not be? But is going to be content with what God has given him or her as gift, and appreciate things as gift. And from there, then you can start thinking about, okay, what does it really mean to be content? And you start thinking about God's gift and about calling, and it's a curved outward instead of a curved inward way of thinking. Okay, I try to find this golden mean of what true contentment is. I'm not trying to find the contentment because there is times I should be discontent and I should be content. And so the question becomes, who is being content or discontent? Not so much trying to find the middle ground, which is always going to be elusive, and it's not going to be neighbor-driven. And so I think the two main differences, three main differences, to repeat myself, but to summarize. One is becoming or being, which comes first. What's the telos, the virtue itself, or the neighbor? And then instead of the kind of the golden mean thing, ask who's doing it.
Yeah. Right?
Because then you have a room for, you also have a room for righteous anger.
Yep.
And you see Jesus, this playing out with God the Father and Jesus as well.
And disillusionment for Jesus. Like a mother hen, I've held up, you know, all day I've been waiting. Yeah.
So, and I think it's more accurate. I think it opens up a broader understanding of the virtues and the vices, instead of just sort of this calculating thing of how I, you know, here's the two extremes. How do I find the middle? And so I think that's a good outline for a book.
Yeah, and so the things below that Michael mentions, and I think you bring up an important distinction. Virtue ethics, Aristotle does really work for what our confessions call civic or civil righteousness. Like for good citizenship, I do want the public schools and the private, but the public especially, to inculcate civic virtue. Right? That's in all of our interests, so that someone can be a good neighbor. And in fact, I might have someone who's an unbeliever who has more civic righteousness, civil righteousness, however we want to put it, than my Christian neighbor, right? Who has really cultivated herself or himself well with horizontal virtue. The issue is that virtue, then it has a boundary, it has a limit. It's not, there's no vertical, right? This isn't going to get you in heaven, but it also, it has a cap. It can't escape from yourself. It's still trapped within you. So that would be divine righteousness, right? Is passive. I receive it through faith. But that gives a new dynamic to what it means to be virtuous. So that can be the above there too. And that's where the neighbor focus, especially when we say neighbor. My civil or civic righteousness is I'm cultivating that for me in neighbor relationships. The saint, that math equation just isn't even there. The saint can get lost fully in neighbor. But so that's not to say that we can't have unbelieving, virtuous people with that things, the things below. Jason, any thoughts on anything we're...
Yeah, this is something that, you know, you guys have done a lot more work with than I have at this point. Although, a couple of things that I've been reading just recently have been talking about this a little bit. And
where have you been reading them, Jason? Or is there something specific you've been reading them for?
Well, it has been for my grad school classes. So.
All right, so Jason, go ahead.
This one was particularly in, is talking about the development or the idea of science and religion and how, and this is kind of what's got me thinking about this a little bit, is that it was talking about how science and religion were both seen as virtues, as they were internal things. And then they've kind of become these external things that are then opposed, or they're become, you know, there's this antagonism between them. And so I guess the thing that I was thinking about with this is, and they said, you know, this is a relatively, or the book is making the case, this is a relatively recent thing, this, you know, flipping virtue inside out, in a sense, right? Where, you know, and I think this is, you know, like even talking about this idea of virtue, and you were maybe hitting on this with some of your introductory thoughts, but that idea of, you know, that these were things to cultivate on the inside, but then, you know, you see them play out on the outside. And and so I guess maybe my question, or, and this is, I think, maybe more of a question than a statement, is, you know, how much of a factor do you think that is in some of the confusion? Or is that just, is that, you know, in some things, but not others? Or, you know, I guess that's maybe kind of the thing that I'm thinking of, just in this concept of virtue as a concept, even, is just a little bit different than the way it used to be talked about versus the way we think of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so you're saying kind of the ancient concept of virtue is kind of, the word's coming from manliness, what it is to be
right,
a good man versus,
yeah,
which was an outward social relationship thing, versus virtue now being this internalization of, or...
No, to say that, you know, this idea of, and I think what you were getting at with the idea of a formation to these virtues, and if this is just, you know, completely confusing the issue, I apologize, but, you know, that idea of this was something that was an internal thing that was, you know, was to be cultivated, you know, and then you were to, that you were to form yourself to that on the inside, rather than something that is, you know,
that we're being shaped by the outside.
Yeah. And that it's all about what you're, you know, like you're not necessarily trying to, it's not to be an exterior demonstration type of thing, I guess maybe it is that. And I think kind of going back to some of the being and becoming language and stuff like that. So like I said, I this is just something that I've...
So that now we're being formed more than shaping ourselves.
Yeah, and the focus becomes on what I'm doing on the outside rather than
shaping myself. So it's not a reflection of my character, right?
My
relationships, I'm doing the external thing and the focus is, am I doing the right external thing? Rather than, is that external thing in keeping with my internal?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, is it... Yeah, and even the idea of speaking of it, of what I do on the outside as a virtue, right? It's acting in a virtuous way, right?
Right.
But it's not, that in and of itself is not the virtue. Is that...
No, I think that makes somewhat... Well, and something I had written down that maybe fits with this is, so I have, right, what's the basis for virtue now? Mm-hmm. And I think we've largely lost shared senses of human nature. Mm-hmm. Like, what is human nature? What's innately human? Which means, like, for virtue, we don't have a shared basis of what are we working with, right? What is it that makes us human that we're trying to work towards doing human well? And maybe this somewhat fits to it, that I'm doing the external things, but those things aren't necessarily, we don't emphasize as much their reflection of who we are. And maybe this goes, so two episodes ago when we were talking about even in Ed now, and teachers complaining about students want to do the work.
Yeah.
Just give me busy work and I'll do it and I'll get the work done and I'll get the grade. As opposed to like, you know, they said, well, now we can't read novels because rather than engaging and doing something that's formative, if this is what you're getting this. So shaping the internal, yeah. Like an encounter with a novel is a formative thing. For a Christian, an encounter with the biblical text is a formative thing. And I do wonder if part of that has become a function of how we even see schooling. Mill and the utilitarians argued that a big part of school was to form, you use external sanctions that people will internalize them and they'll behave so that everyone can behave in a way that meets the greater good. And I don't think Mill like meant to get rid of a sense of like, well, I want to have solid internal character. But I think as that's been taken it to its logical end and you've lost a lot of the influence of Christianity in our day, you've lost a lot of like classical education and, you know, historic notions of what it is to be a human being, what it is to build character. I think you see this even in the culture in sports where, you know, so much of coaching in sports historically was character building, you know.
Right, yeah.
That there is, I think, maybe a divorce that defies both what Aristotle and Jesus are teaching. In that the question of being is just not a primary question for many now, maybe? I mean,
I think that, you know, that's just some of the question, because I think...
How do you form an amorphous thing?
Yeah, yeah. And even that just that overall concept of, you know, that idea of virtue is something I think it's thrown around a lot, but that maybe people have different or are using it in different ways, which I think makes that conversation more confusing.
And I think that fits in a social nature too, because, you know, so many for what the ancients, when they're talking about virtue, they were talking about the life of the polis, social nature, how you're cultivating yourself, but you're doing this, right?
Yeah.
In ways that are neighbor focused in the sense of you're living in community. And so even if that, some of that Aristotle's virtues are how you're seen to be magnanimous, right? In Christ, there's that dynamic as well. You know, when Paul and Christ talk about the Christian life, they give these dispositions that are neighbor-focused. And I do think as we've lost a shared sense of what human nature is, beyond maybe viewing that in a biological way.
Right.
We don't have shared conceptions of societal conceptions either. You know, what's a normal horizontal relationship? We increasingly can't define that in the home. You know, we struggle to define that in the workplace. As relationships become more artificial and less defined, I think you're right. How do you speak of virtue in those settings? Like what, how do you speak of it in a way that it's been spoken of in the past if we don't have the conceptions that drove both the Christian and the, not just Aristotelian, but ancient view of those things? And I think that is, I mean, even in the Christian church and with students that we get, where you, there's that extra step of having to explain to them why this would even matter.
I think, you know, it's kind of interesting. This is an example, I think, of talking about like shared understanding of some of these things, and you mentioned sports as a place where, you know, so oftentimes this was where some of these things,
especially team sports,
and I'd come across a discussion on a basketball game. It was a women's basketball game, and it was a team that was just starting their program, and they were playing up a division, and so they were already struggling, and then they had somehow scheduled up a division, and they were beaten by over 100 points, but it was also that the upper division team was still like pressing full on fast breaking until after the fourth quarter started. And the discussion was this a classless move or not? And the interesting thing to me was how evenly divided the discussion was to say, hey, this is not, you know, rec league, you know, type. This is, you know, collegiate sports, you know. But at the same time, it's still kind of a classless move to be pouring it on, even if you're playing your subs, to be playing that style of ball just for the purpose of running up the score, seemingly. And how evenly divided that was, which, again, just kind of, I think, illustrates the point that you're making, like how varied in things that were kind of considered almost right. You know, a universal thing, and maybe even not that long ago.
Yeah, and that would have been considered a reflection of character.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and yeah, and well, we're getting at 35 minutes, so I've got to wrap it up. But maybe I think the big thing that just to come back to, again, is if we're going to talk about virtue and if there's a place for virtue, how do I get it, and where is it focused? And I think that. We talked about it in a previous episode. The church, again, here has remedies. It across time, the church has learned some things. And I think hopefully the contribution we can make, if we're going to church well, so to speak, which is to be biblical, is the reminder that, again, as Michael said, virtue cannot exist without first being a real virtue, without first being, and that is Christ has to make us something. He has to declare us something. That true Christian virtue, sanctification, is a gift of God through faith in Christ. Like all good things, they come from the Father. It comes from the Father of heavenly lights. And then that it is, to a great extent, done to me. When you think of the list that St. Paul gives, or when Jesus talks about the, you know, these things in the Sermon on the Mount or elsewhere, these are things that I learned from God through neighbor relationships. And so the sins are usually deeds or habits, but the virtues or the fruits of the Spirit are dispositions. And these are dispositions that are honed in neighbor relationships. I learn humility by being humbled. I learn patience by being annoyed. I learn gentleness by being hurt or by causing hurt. And these things are done to me as I live in the vulnerability of love relationships, self-giving relationships, because I've been, as Mike has spoken of before, turned outside of myself in Christ. And I think that's partly why we can speak of Christian virtue arising from our baptism, which puts us to death to ourself and rises us. I've been crucified and now I'm a new person. To live to Christ, and to live to Christ is to live to neighbor, because where is Christ? Whatever you have done for the least of these, you have done for me, which I hope and I think is a relief when people finally get it. Because no more is it I have to wake up every day and go to work on myself to become virtuous. I know the virtue can come to me. Right, and some days are going to be messy, and neighbor relationships are sometimes difficult, and I'm not always going to do the best thing I would like to do, and yet God is going to use me vocationally, in and through the person of my neighbor, going to go to work on me for my own good, and so these virtues are dispositions, right? It's learning how to see and how to love. And I think that's where, if we can get back to that with sanctification, and one can only do that in the forgiveness of sins. That's the only way you're set free to do that, is in the forgiveness of sins. Otherwise, you're paralyzed because you might fail. But God sets us free then even to fail, which is when true love happens, when you're willing to risk yourself. And risking yourself doesn't have to be some great thing. In the last episode, Jason, you hit on this important point of, we feel like we have to do great things. Sometimes risking yourself is, you're tired, but the diaper needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. Is you had a long day at work, but the kids need to eat.
Yeah.
You know, it's you've got work to do, but your colleague is in your office door. and so God goes to work on you in those moments. And so hopefully what we've done a little bit of here, besides Mike researching Michael names, Wade names still, or memes, is to say that even when it comes to virtue, which I think is often we see as just a law thing, God wants to set us free. God goes to work on us for us, but also for a neighbor, and not goes to work on us to make us something he can love or someone who can go to heaven, but as someone he already loves who's already going to heaven. And that's a great place to be in, and that's a great way to grow in virtue, which is, I would say, to grow in grace, to grow confident in the love that is already ours. Dare I say, it is simply to let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set 'em up another round, I set 'em up another round, I set 'em up another round. One more round won't get me down.